Hey everybody, join us as we delve into our favorite dark tales and paranormal mysteries.
Venture with us beyond the safe places that exist in daylight as we go
beyond the shadows. True crime.
Paranormal.
Hauntings.
UFOs.
Cryptids and unsolved mysteries.
Conspiracy theories.
Past lives.
Reincarnation.
And all the like are just a few of the topics that we will tackle.
If it haunts your fucking dreams, then it will be on our show.
Shadows where you found me at. You can't see me in the deepest blacks. When your heart start racing and you see the cracks, all these creepy things that you might attract. All the demons be where the action's at. So listen up if you want it. UFOs, all them ghosts, we got everything that you want. Whoa.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
Hi and welcome back to a special bonus episode of Beyond the Shadows.
Welcome back, Shadow People, for a bonus.
Special Tuesday bonus. You guys have been so good. We've been having a great time. The numbers are growing. We're super grateful, guys.
Yeah, everything's been going great. We really appreciate it. We appreciate you guys sharing and putting it out there, making your families listen.
The only thing we're lacking on is the fire pits. So this special bonus episode is not going to have one. Write in, guys. Anything you got.
Yeah, we're in desperate need of some fire pits. We have a few that I've misplaced and misshuffled I'm going to look for. But, yeah, we're getting pretty low.
So if you've sent one in that you haven't heard yet, then send it again. Chances are it got misplaced.
Yeah, that's Ryan's fault. I don't know how, but I'm not taking the heat.
I fucked it up. I accept the heat for that.
Yeah. So what's in the news today?
So we got a lady this past week at Memphis Airport who was trying to smuggle marijuana, obviously. My first reaction, everybody's reaction, is probably like, who fucking cares?
Yeah, it's just a little bit of weed, big deal.
Smuggling a little weed, big deal. Yeah. She was trying to smuggle 56 pounds in her bag. Now, anybody knows the weight limit on a checked bag is 50 pounds.
So. Dude, that is so ballsy.
Yeah, so she was trying to check a bag that was not only over the limit, but it contained nothing but weed.
it couldn't have had anything else.
No chance. It probably didn't even have a bag around it because it was over the limit.
You know that shit stunk.
I know.
You just got the littlest bag in your fucking pocket, and you could smell it everywhere.
So generally, you're like, oh, man, that sucks for her. But you read that, you're like, what the fuck?
Come on, dumbass.
How did you think that wasn't going to happen? I can't believe they cracked that case.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you're over by 6 pounds. Hold on. You just shovel out some weed into the...
Let's see what we can take out of here. How about the weed? Yeah. We're on the side pocket. We got what? Oh, yeah, it's a little weed.
I want to get rid of the weed.
A Belgian man was pulled over back in April of 22, and his blood alcohol came out to twice the legal limit. So this was actually his second arrest for drunk driving. His first one came in 2019. He was acquitted at trial, though, apparently being the only drunk driver in history to say that they hadn't had anything to drink. And he was telling the truth.
Yeah, he was twice over the legal limit. But this guy had his own home brewery built right into his belly.
Yeah, this case is confusing. Oh, it's not confusing. It's just weird.
It's crazy. And I've heard of this before, this case. But his body actually produces alcohol.
It does. Yeah.
Which is insane.
It's really insane. So it's called ABS or auto brewery syndrome. The shit sounds made up.
It does sound made up.
But it isn't. The disorder causes the stomach's natural yeast to produce ethanol, which produces the person who exhibits signs of drunkenness, including slurred speech and difficulty walking. And I know quite a few people that were probably looking up how to get this shit on purpose. So they can cut down on their bar tab. pretty soon they're going to be claiming they get like, my body made its own crack.
Yeah. You can't blame this on me. My body loves the shit.
All right. So we got one last story it's another good one. So a new home security system is on its way that takes things to a whole new level.
This is amazing.
I'm not sure if it's OZIT or just OZIT. not sure how you say it. It's a Slovenia-based startup that's raising money to produce their AI-powered home surveillance system that uses facial recognition software and an app-based system to fire paintballs and tear gas pellets at intruders.
It's the best. You know, you get all those people stealing the packages all the time, and you could just open up on them with a paintball.
They're going to tear that shit up.
Dude, and paintballs, have you been hit with a paintball?
I have.
They fucking hurt, yeah, man. They hurt.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, like really bad. It isn't like a little tap.
Tear gas pellets.
Yeah, and yeah, not only is it going to hurt when you get hit, but yeah, your eyes are going to burn. You're going to be all fucked up.
So it's going to have a night vision capabilities and a speaker system to issue warnings and instructions. So apparently homeowners can actually, within the system, mark loved ones as no fire targets. That's a quote.
Let's hope they can't change that.
I can see all sorts of shit going
on. Oh, yeah. I can see this going bad real fast.
Guys are going to be.
I love the idea.
Guys are going to be marking like their mother-in-law as a high fire target. And like, babe, I don't know what happened.
Ah, I missed fire.
Pizza guys are just gonna get reamed.
No shit. This is not a good time to be an Uber Eats person.
No, I think this thing's great in theory.
Yeah,
but there's so many technical glitches. I can see shit just going.
Oh, this is disgusting. This could go sideways so fast.
I'm kind of chuckling.
I can't wait for it to come out.
I'm kind of chuckling because you can see everything going wrong.
Oh yeah, for sure. Away.
Okay, so for tonight's special episode, me and Scott were talking the other day, and throughout 78 episodes and all the stuff we've covered, the one thing we've actually never touched on is Bigfoot.
Which is one of our favorites.
It is.
Yeah, like we had said before, it's probably one of the most likely to be true as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely.
As far as cryptids go, Bigfoot's top of the list.
And it's global.
Yeah, it's not just in one spot. It's not like the Jersey Devil, which is just in Jersey. It's literally everywhere.
Sure, I'm pretty sure on all continents there is some version of Bigfoot. They might not,
and
use,
it's been around,
they might not use that name, but there,
it's been around for thousands of years. And they say there's hundreds of different names for Bigfoot. From different Indian tribes throughout the country, there's hundreds of different names. So, I mean, that's what gives it some bite, you know?
So we're going to skip like the general descriptions and all that type of stuff and assume that everybody just knows kind of sort of what Bigfoot is. And we're going to get into some more of the famous sightings of it, so to speak. And we'll go from there. So,
all right.
This is our Bigfoot special, guys. Hopefully you guys like it.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
All right, so two of the most famous Bigfoot sightings / encounters from history both came from 1924. Ape Canyon is a narrowing gorge that sits just to the northeast of Washington's Mount St. Helens. In July of 1924, a group of gold prospectors had built a cabin in the area, and they were spending their days searching for gold. A group of large gorilla-like people, standing 7 foot tall by the men's estimation, set upon them with rocks one day. One of the miners, Fred Beck, fired his rifle at one of the creatures and struck it 3 times in the chest. He said the creature staggered and toppled off the clifftops into the inaccessible canyon below. The men then returned to their cabin for the night. Well after dark, when all of the men had gone to sleep, the creatures came calling, perhaps for revenge. The cabin began to rock as it was being pelted by large rocks from all sides. The mountain devils, quote, as the men called them, kept up a steady barrage of stones, trapping the men inside. From time to time, one of the men would fire at the creatures outside, and all would go quiet for a few minutes. The attacks would always begin again after a short break. At one point, one of the beasts reached through a hole in the cabin wall and seized an axe. The men were able to thwart him just as he attempted to pull the axe out through the hole. The attack continued uninterrupted throughout the night, and as day broke, it suddenly went quiet. The men crept out of the cabin quietly, expecting the attack to commence again at any moment, but the creatures appeared to have gone away. There were large rocks scattered all over, and giant footprints were all over the place. All five were able to successfully make their way back to civilization, where they reported what had occurred. When the news of the story broke, Beck agreed to take two forest rangers back to the scene and see what they could find. Rangers J.H. Huffman and William Welch went to the remote location to investigate, but they found nothing to convince them that any aspect of the story was true. They couldn't find any sign of the dead creature, nor were they impressed by the stones laying all around the outside of the cabin. They believed that the miners had likely placed them there themselves to give their story credibility. They were also unimpressed with the footprints, and they believed the man had created those as well. Fred Beck went on to write a book about the incident, and he theorized that the attackers were likely alien beings. Others thought that the attackers might have been local youths just pulling a prank. Now, the acoustics of the region could have contributed to the voices sounding beastly, perhaps, but the remote location makes the youth theory extremely far-fetched. So the site of the cabin is no longer known, and the area today looks vastly different 100 years after the incident due to the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. So the whole area, the geography is just different. Everything's melted and changed. So it's impossible to say what was what.
That's 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly 100 years ago to this year. So it's an interesting story. It's impossible for me to say. I just don't have anything to base it on.
You know,
it's plausible. I don't know.
The thing where they reach for the axe, out of the whole story, that's my problem.
My biggest problem is I agree. I thought the same thing. I'm thinking, okay, there's chinks in a log cabin, but who the hell leaves a hole big enough for a whole arm and an axe to come through? That's just shoddy workmanship.
Exactly.
Unless it's an open window, that's a huge
hole. How would it know through the hole that there's an axe there? And why would it be after an axe? If it's a Sasquatch, you know, that's – it's funny that a little thing like that can –
No, I agree.
Ruin a whole story for you.
That's what jumped out to me at the story too, about the story too.
Yeah, I mean it's.
And some versions, I should state that that Beck shooting the Bigfoot. Most versions takes place before the attack, and that's what causes the attack. There's a couple of versions where they had a couple run-ins with the Bigfoots, but the shooting takes place on their way out. So that even though those details of the story aren't consistent,
no,
and so anybody who thinks I fucked that up, I didn't. That's just the versions aren't consistent. So I placed it on the intro because that's where
it makes more sense.
That's what most versions has. His shooting of the Bigfoot is what causes the attack. But there are a few versions where they get rocks thrown at him, and then Fred Beck shoots the Bigfoot on the way out. Doesn't make as much sense.
No. The way that you did it makes more sense to me, but that's how I've heard it too. So.
Hello, Beyond the Shadows listeners.
I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
It's an interesting story. I'm going to place the plausibility of that one. My likelihood, I'm gonna put that at a 5. It's possible. I wouldn't stake my life on it. I don't know. I'm indifferent on that one. I'm going to put it at
There's
a 5.
A lot of Bigfoot stuff that I'm indifferent on. Now, I'm going to tell you that I'm a believer in
Seth. Oh, so am I. Absolutely.
But there's so many of these stories. There's so many hoaxes. There's so much stuff that even all the way back then. I mean, this is pretty Bigfoot.
I looked into this one quite a bit, you know, so different versions. Another red flag for this story for me is Beck is the only one. The five guys, they all made it out. None of those four other guys say anything about it anywhere that I can find. Beck is the only one that ever spoke.
Only one talking about
it. Yeah. Again, maybe, you know, there's a stigma to talking about shit, you know.
Maybe the rest of them died. They lived to like 23 back then.
They died of old age. Yeah, at 31.
They aged out way before.
It,
He was one of those rare ones that made it to 60. So that's an interesting story.
All right, man, your turn. All right, what do you got for us?
I am going to talk about the Patterson-Gimlin film.
This is the Patterson film. This is the mother of all films, right?
Yeah, so I mean, this is the holy grail of Bigfoot evidence. If you don't think you've seen this footage, well, you're probably wrong. This is it. I mean, it's the one, I think.
And this is the Bigfoot footage. If you've seen Bigfoot footage, this is the one.
If you see a picture of Bigfoot, it's from this footage. The film was shot on like 16 millimeter film. It was just under 1 minute, and there were 952 frames. But every inch of this film has been gone over frontwards and backwards. They say that other than the JFK shooting, this film has been investigated and scrutinized more than any other film on the planet. So the film was shot on October 20th, 1967 by Roger Patterson while on an expedition with Bob Gimlin. They were on horseback in Northern California at the Del Norte County near Bluff Creek. I know I said that wrong, but you guys are used to that.
you made it almost a minute in.
So I know, right? I'm in my second paragraph.
You did good.
Thanks, man. So the men were on location shooting what they called it's like a pseudo documentary. It was about two men, a cowboy and an Indian tracker, in search of Bigfoot. The reason the men had chosen this area was because in recently footprints had been discovered. I think it was like a road crew had found some Bigfoot feet, you know, the footprints. Yeah. And it wasn't of one, but it was of several different Sasquatch. There was like three different sizes. So the whole idea was that they thought it was the actual Bigfoot family.
Oh, I getcha.
So they said that Patterson, he was a big Bigfoot guy. He was a Bigfoot researcher at this time. I think he was one of the few. But he got interested in it, Bigfoot, after he read an article in True Magazine back in like December 1959. He became infatuated after that. So in 1961, Sanders, the individual, had published the Encyclopedia of Abominable Snowmen. The legends come to life. So, I mean, these are the things that Patterson was infatuated with.
Yeah.
And so just right off, Patterson, they describe him, he's kind of a shady dude. You know, out of credibility, out of the two of them, he's the least credible. But, you know, he was a different guy. Both of them, Patterson and Gimlin, were both rodeo. They were real cowboys.
Rodeo guys.
Yeah, they were both rodeo guys. Gimlin was actually 1/4 Apache. So he was an actual tracker. So I mean, he wasn't just playing it in the...
So Gimlin was the guy who shot the film?
No. It was actually shot by Patterson.
Oh, okay.
Gimlin was along with him. The two of them were friends. They grew up they actually grew up together, and they were friends like off and on. They were good friends, but they had stretches where they didn't hang out, didn't talk or anything like that. And no one's real surprised by Patterson. Is like, he's that character that like, he's probably going to owe you money. He's probably going to tell you he'll pay you back, and probably has every intention to, but never gets around to it. He's that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But Gimlin, from everything that I've read, is a pretty solid dude. So
everybody's got that one shady buddy.
Absolutely. But Patterson actually wrote his own book. He had a book. It came out actually before this sighting. It was called Do Abominable Snowmen of America Really Exist? So, and this was a self-published book. He published it himself. The book was said to be mostly a collection of newspaper clippings put together with some of his own. He did like circus poster style stuff that he put in it. The book, however, it contained 20 pages of previously unpublished interviews and letters. It had 17 drawings by Patterson. So Patterson actually was a decent artist. They said that he wasn't like a great artist, but he did pretty well and actually had drawn out a lot of the stuff of encounters, like the one that you had just done of Ape Canyon.
Yeah.
He had done illustrations and stuff for that also, and that was included in the book. He had 5 hand-drawn maps and like 20 different photos, mostly, like I said, drawn from him or other people. So he was definitely a Bigfoot guy. It was early Friday afternoon, October 20th, 1967. The two of the men were riding, northeast upstream on horseback along the east bank of Bluff Creek. Somewhere around 1:15, they came to a laid-down tree with the roots ripped from the ground. The creek rounded the corner at this point, and as the men followed, there was a log jam. So I guess back in 1964, there was a big flood in the area, and as a creek came down, it pushed a whole bunch of trees, and there was a jam full of logs right there.
Move shit.
Yep, so when they were rounding that corner, that's when they spotted the creature. They said it was either crouching beside the creek, or one of them said it was standing. It depends on whose story that you're listening to, but one of them said that it was actually crouching. The other ones, by the time they had seen it, it was standing on the opposite side of the creek.
Gotcha.
Patterson initially, he estimated that it was probably 6 feet, 6 inches tall to maybe 7 foot. But later, this is one of the things, he actually changed that to probably like 7.5 feet tall. And this is a big sticking point for people. It was one of the things that he changed his initial, it was 6.5 feet to 7.5 feet. So a whole foot difference.
That is a big difference.
It is. It really, especially if you're 5 foot, you stand next to somebody who's 6 foot, it looks like a ton.
6'6" a difference. Big, but it's plausible. Then you jump it up to 7'6" and that's
right.
I'm still plausible amongst Bigfoot, but human in a costume is much less likely.
Well, yeah, way less likely. So the film shows what Patterson and Gimlin claim was a large, hairy, bipedal, ape-like figure with short. So it was either silvery brown or dark reddish brown. It's hard to tell in the picture. It looks more black to me in the picture, photo.
It looks totally black.
In the whole film.
Yeah, the film.
Hair covered most of his body, including what I didn't even realize this as a kid. And I found it fascinating when I didn't find out till way later on. But if you look close at this Bigfoot had prominent breasts.
Yeah, I saw them. Yeah.
And I didn't realize that when I was younger. I was completely oblivious to it. But because this goes to the people who claim that this was a costume. If this was a costume that he bought, he had to make some serious adjustments to it. And what an odd thing to add, you know? There's so many things to this story.
Yeah.
But it had, when you go back and look at it, you can tell it's a female. And they actually, because of this, it actually became known as Patty.
I think I was familiar with that, but I somewhere along the way read that. I mean, as a kid, I didn't notice that, nor was I looking for it. I think somewhere on the way I read somebody.
Hi, I'm Natasha with Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy. Embark with me on a journey to uncover the details involving cryptids, haunted houses, and unsolved mysteries. Get ready to awaken your curiosity and explore the unknown. Ask questions, and together, let's unravel the secrets behind the legends.
You know what I mean?
And you know, the whole film is all over the place and I'll explain why. But when it first starts, the film's really hard to track because he's like all over the place.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And now they've stabilized it. You can pick up a lot of the stuff that you couldn't see before.
For sure.
So, but the figure in the film matched the description of Bigfoot. Patterson claimed he was about at one point 25 feet away from the creature. And he also said, so when they came up around the corner, it startled his horse. And his horse reared up and actually fell over backwards. And this is the reason that everything is so shaky or whatever. He actually was trapped under his horse for a minute. And there was, when he went back, he showed people that the stirrup on his saddle was actually bent from where the horse had fallen over. His foot was stuck in the stirrup of the saddle.
I didn't get the impression that at any point he was within 25 feet. It seems like he was much further from,
so,
judging from the video.
There's a reason for that, okay. Is because they came up on it. They didn't have film running. All right. So the film was brought out after. So he flipped, the horse reared up, fell over backwards, and he's under it. He's the one with the camera.
Yeah.
And Gimlin's up ahead of him. And so what happens is he has to get himself out from under the horse. But he's a horseman. This guy rides horses. He's a rodeo guy. He knows how to handle a horse. Yeah. He gets out from it. He's able to grab the camera from the saddlebags. And so this is the period time. And so he grabs his camera. He runs towards.
So the Bigfoot's moving away.
It's moving. It's walking along. And I think he said it didn't seem to. It wasn't afraid of them. It was just doing its thing.
Nowhere on the video does it look spooked.
No. And so he grabs the camera and he's running towards it. So this is why the film, he's trying to film at the same time.
That's why it's shaking at the
beginning. It's shaking like crazy. It's all over the place.
He's making up ground.
Yeah. So he's trying to catch up. And he gets to, like, I believe to that tree that's down. And that's when he tries to stabilize it. That's the middle of the film. So let me go back a little bit. He said he spent about 20 seconds trying to get himself out from underneath the horse and controlling the horse, got to the side, grabbed the camera. Then he ran towards the creature while filming. He yelled back to Gimlin, "Cover me." And he meant, get your gun out, you know? And so that's what he did. The two of them ahead of time had actually agreed that if they did see a Bigfoot, because they were out there looking for Bigfoot, yeah, if they did see one, that they wouldn't kill it unless one of them was in, they wouldn't shoot it or maim it unless one of them was actual life was in danger. But he did tell them, cover me, you know, and then he went running. So Gimlin crossed the creek on horseback after Patterson had run well before it, riding on the path somewhat to the left of Patterson. And somewhere beyond his position, Patterson estimated he came within 60 to 90 feet of Patty. They're calling her Patty now. So the creature had walked away from them a distance of about like 120 feet. Before Patterson was able to run after it. The resulting film, about 59.5 seconds long. So, and this was 16 frames per minute that they were filming at. And initially, it's quite shaky until Patterson got about 80 feet from the figure. And at that point, the figure glanced over its right shoulder at the men. This is the most famous shot of it all.
Yeah, that shot is extremely memorable.
Yeah. And Patterson fell to his knees in frame 264. So that's one of the, when they filmed this, like I said, there was 952 different pictures. It stopped, you know, I mean, it's so different than what we have today. But the thing about it is, this is on actual film. This is really, really hard to fake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's very easy to tell if something's, this film's been manipulated at all.
Yeah, frauds are easier with today's technology. Fraudulent is easier. So if they faked it, they did it in person. They didn't digitally enhance it.
Yeah. With this, if this is fake and it's not real, it's a guy in a costume. It's not manipulation of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I said, that film's been scrutinized by, and no one has ever come out and been able to say that that film was tampered with at all.
No, I don't think the film was tampered with at all.
Actually, do you know the original film is lost?
Is it?
Yeah, so they don't. There was like 10 copies of the original film made. So Patterson would later say it had an expression when it looked over his shoulder at him. He was quoted as saying, "You know what it's like when an umpire tells you one more word and you're out of the game?" He said that's what it felt like. He said that it looked over his shoulder and he gave him like a nasty kind of look.
Stink eye.
But he said that wasn't the first time. Actually, before the camera started rolling, he said it looked at them like three different times. It looked over its shoulder. But at this point is when it started picking up its pace. Like all of a sudden it realized that maybe these thinks could be a threat to it or whatever. It gave it that one last dirty look, picked up its pace, and off into the woods.
So the first look was probably a simple warning, like back off. And when they didn't, it probably
kept on its pace.
Progressive worst stink eye.
Yeah.
You had those at the bars back in the day.
Oh, still get them. I go upstairs and get one. So anyways, after that last look over the shoulder, she disappears into a bunch of trees. And then she's seen once more with a final 15 seconds after Patterson moved about 10 feet to get a better vantage point. So then after that, the film ran out. And that's one of the other big things. They're like, you only got 59 seconds of this. Why? They were filming they were making a pseudo documentary. Like, I mean, when you do a documentary, you have to have like B-roll and you have to have like different stuff to, you know, if they're going to say a lot of stuff is reenacted and stuff like that when they're filming a documentary. They didn't have anything before this. So the beginning of the film, Gimlin had actually been recording like scenery and, you know, them on horseback and stuff like that. So they had a second roll of film, but they hadn't put it back in. There was still just less than a minute left on it.
Oh, so you're saying the background footage was on a different roll?
No, it was on the front of this roll.
Oh.
So this ran out at 59 because the film was whoever knows how long. This was the last 59 seconds, else they could have kept filming.
So we didn't have time to change
reels. So when they stopped and actually did change reels, it was long gone at that point. So actually Gimlin had chased after it for a while, but Patterson said that he actually called him back because he was afraid that when they had seen footprints originally, like I said, there was several different ones, and he was concerned after this that maybe there was still some hanging around, and he was in the woods now because his horse took off after this, and he was in the woods with no rifle because his rifle was on the horse, and he felt vulnerable, so he called for Gimlin to come back. That's what they say. So they were able to go up. They did get to a plaster cast of – they found the best right foot and left foot, and were able to get plaster cast of those feet. And if you look behind you, Ryan, that's one of them right there. I have cast of the cast from this.
Oh, nice.
It's just a copy of the cast, and it's
– it's a big fucking foot though.
You look at that thing. It's huge. I'll put a picture of it up on the website, but – that's huge.
If that's the cast of a real beast, that thing is a fucking monster.
So, I mean, and that's kind of how it went down. That's how the film, they claim the film was shot. It was, the whole encounter lasted 2 minutes, and it's something that was in the rest of their lives.
So what does your gut tell you? 1 to 10.
Well, there's so much more Patterson information.
Footage, is the Patterson footage legit?
Okay, so there's another podcast called Astonishing Legends, and they dive into this one. They do like 6 parts. I mean, I did 10 minutes. They did 6 parts, and it's 2 to 3 hours each part. And they dive into every aspect of this. And there's a lot of stuff out there. And I would have gone that I thought maybe it wasn't real. But just recently, I watched some footage of, like I said, this film was all over the place. It was shaking, and it was hard to see. But they've been able to stabilize it. And you can look at it now and the details. So there's a few things that make me think there's a good possibility it could be real. One of the things is supposedly, say it's a man in a suit. And that's what we're getting down to. The film is not manipulated. In my mind, the film is 100% legit.
I think most people would agree.
It would have to be a man in a suit. So that's what you got to look at. So the man in the suit, the claim was that he had a, because there's people that have come out and said that they were the man in the suit. It's Bob. I'm gonna fuck up his name because that's what I do. But anyways,
I've heard the same thing.
Yeah, and they said that he had a football helmet on and shoulder pads to make him look bigger and stuff like that, and that people claim to have made the suit, and none of that stuff, from what I've seen, the evidence that came out actually match up to what their claims are. Like the guy who said that they made the suit, there was a company out there that did make like monkey suits, gorilla suits, but they claimed that they had
he had ordered it online. Not online. They certainly wasn't online. He had mail ordered it, and they had sent it to him or whatever.
Early Amazon.
But they said it was one-piece suit. The gentleman who said that he wore the suit said it was a top that was like a shirt and pants, and then the hands were separate and everything. They don't match at all. And the company, trying to think what the name of the company was, I had sent a suit to one of these people who were investigating, and they put it on. It didn't match up to what it looked like at all. So you could really dive into this. I don't believe. So, all right. Let me get back to what I was saying. If you look at the new film where it's stabilized, you can see on the feet, the toes, their feet are different than ours if they're real. And you can see the toes on the thing bend upwards. Like when they go to stride, you can actually see those toes bending up, which if it's in a suit, you're wearing shoes inside of that suit, there's no way you're going to see that. And the other thing was,
not only that, not to cut you off, in 1967, would they have the foresight, if they were forging this thing, to make that minute detail that would have never been perceptible on that day's film?
Right. The other thing on it now is when they show it as it's stepping, when they can zoom in on the film, you can see the calf muscle flex. You can see it going from smoother to being like a balled up top of a calf muscle, which if this was a suit, it would have hung. You know, that would have been more like a sleeve. You wouldn't have been able to see that unless that suit was really tight. And then what I noticed on the film, and they mentioned it, is when you look, it looks like it's got an ass crack. Would they have put that in any gorilla suit? Would they have had, especially back then?
Maybe that's just what you were looking for.
Maybe I was. I mean, maybe I thought she was hot.
That's sort of your thing.
And if it was,
I saw the breast, then I looked for the ass.
And if it's a suit, would it have had breasts? There's no way. He would have had to add that after the fact.
Unless he's super detail-oriented. No, yeah.
And that's not what you get about him. No. Anything that anyone has talked about him. So, I mean, the problem is the dude, he was a little shady. Gimlin doesn't sound like he was. So the whole thing, if it would come down to if it was faked, he must not have known. That's what I look at it. I'm 50-50 on this one. I'd have to put it at a 5, maybe a 6. I want to believe it, but at the same time, there's so much stuff about him that's, you know, his brother-in-law was the one that kind of took over. Gimlin was kind of left out of this once they started, like, publicizing it and everything. And he was all about the dollar.
If this was a fake, and I'm not saying it was, Patterson himself should have stayed out of it. Maybe been involved, but kept himself out of the actual video. Because I think his attachment to it is what raises the red flags for most people, because he didn't have the most honest reputation.
Right. So him being tied to it for sure.
Maybe if he was the one, if it was a fake and he designed it, he should have stayed out of it.
The thing is,
execution.
He had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It had come up once before this, and then after, 2 years after this happened, it took his life. So he died.
I didn't realize he died that early.
He died 2 years after this happened. And so the Gimlin and him had a bit of a falling out after this because of, basically because him and his brother-in-law took off and left. Gimlin was left cold with nothing from any of this. He didn't get any money or anything from the film or the filming or anything.
I knew Patterson died young. I didn't realize he's been gone that long.
But he did. But Gimlin did go visit him in the hospital and let bygones be bygones. And they were said that they talked about, because of all the scrutiny and everything they went through, Patterson's, one of their last conversations was Patterson's like, I want to get some tranquilizers and get past this. He thought he was going to get past his lymphoma enough to get back out there. And he said, let's go back out there and we'll tranquilize the bitch and we'll bring it back here to prove to everybody, because everything that they'd gone through, people not believing or whatever. So that was on his deathbed.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. It's definitely the most iconic.
Oh, yeah. That's famous. If you've seen any footage of Bigfoot, this is almost certainly the footage.
Yeah. So, like I said, if he wasn't shady, I'd been like, yeah, that's after seeing the stabilized film, it makes me start. I would have said no until I saw that new film. You know, I think that was done in 2019 where they actually got it stabilized.
I haven't seen that yet. I'm going to look into it, but I would agree with you. I would, having not seen the new footage that you're referring to or the new adaptation of that footage, I would put myself at probably a 5 or 6. Same about you.
Yeah. I mean, if we didn't have that film, I'd have been a lot lower. But that film really, I think if you all should take a look at it and look at the things that they're talking about with those toes. You can see the toes bending upwards. And I don't know how you'd do that in a suit. If you had shoes on under the suit, you'd have to have shoes on. You know your front toes aren't going to bend up.
And I don't know why you would have done that in 1967 to begin with, because it wouldn't have been viewable back then.
So the guys who told him that, they said that he wore the suit, said Patterson told him he was going to give him $1,000 to wear the suit. $1,000 back then is like $8,000 now.
Oh, it's a fuck.
It's close to $10,000. And Patterson didn't have any cash. It's just what he got from his brother, his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law, you know, funded a lot of his expeditions that were out there and stuff. So supposedly that's how much he would have gotten for it. Yet Patterson, they also, when they claim that he bought the suit, he paid $1,000 for it. No, is that right? It's something like that. That maybe it was $500. I'm going to get that screwed up, so people are going to chastise me. Anyways, it was a lot of money. It came up to thousands of dollars today, but he didn't have that kind of cash, you know? And if he did have that kind of cash, the camera that he used to film it, he rented it. He had rented it because it's a higher quality. He rented it to do this documentary. If he had that kind of cash to throw around for pay this dude to wear a costume and pay this much for the costume, wouldn't he have just bought a camera? The camera wasn't as much as those things were.
You can argue that both ways. I mean, he's pushing all his chips in on this piece of footage.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much. But
you could argue for and against the credibility due to just what you just said. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. That's this whole case.
I mean, he went out there looking for Bigfoot, which doesn't mean it isn't true. But I mean, he pushed all his chips in on finding a really crucial piece of footage.
He'd been to that area before.
Which he did.
He'd been to that area before. He'd been there a couple times.
So he either really did his research and fucking nailed it, or he got phenomenally lucky with all his money. Bet on that one ship, so to speak. So you can see it from any number of different ways.
Absolutely.
So that argues for him and against him. So it's really what you want to believe. The footage is amazing.
Yep.
Is it real or is it not? That's the question.
The footage is real.
The footage is real. But I mean, whether it's a guy in a monkey suit or it's an actual Bigfoot is debatable. And so, I put myself somewhere around a 6. It's amazing footage. Yeah. Is it Bigfoot? I don't know. I guess that's the whole point of the piece.
The other thing that they said the Bigfoot, apparently their legs aren't that long. Their arms are long and their torso's really long, but the legs aren't that long. And they don't line up where it bends. The knee doesn't bend in the same spot as it does on a typical human. So it sits a little lower and not higher, what you would think. And the footprints were into the ground a lot deeper than what an average person could have push up.
So it tells you it was a heavy person.
Yeah. So, I mean, they did get cast. Like I said, that's the cast right there.
Yeah.
So it would have had to been some serious weight to push into the ground the way that it did. And that, you see how that is. That's pretty deep.
Yeah.
That's what, 1.5, 2 inches?
Well, the thing's got to be fucking 16 inches long. Have you ever measured it?
I think it's 18 and a half. Yes. 17 and a half?
It's 18? A monster fucking footprint. So if 17 and a half inches long, that's a big goddamn creature. It's got to be 500 pounds minimum.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would sink down.
Into the ground. Yeah. So I don't know, guys. Let us know what you think. You know, send us some messages. Tell us what you think.
If you haven't seen it, definitely check out the Patterson footage.
Yeah, especially the new stabilized stuff. Check that out. So,
all right. So we got one last story to our Bigfoot special. So this one's about a prospector, sort of like my first one. That's also set in 1924. So Canadian prospector Albert Ostman was camping near Toba Inlet, located on the coast of British Columbia, across from Vancouver. Ostman was a lumberjack by trade, and he was on a vacation camping trip. He was led into the region by an indigenous guide who told him the story of a white man who used to prospect in the area. And he would frequently come out of the forest with gold he had taken from his mine. He didn't disclose its location, but he would drink heavily while he was back in town. And when the funds ran out, he would then retreat back into the woods to his mine for more. On one of these excursions, he was said to have been killed by a Sasquatch. Ostman wasn't familiar with the legend of the Sasquatch, so the guy described them as hairy beings that stood over 8 foot tall, sometimes. But he said they were not animals, but people. When Ostman told the man he didn't believe in any such creature, the man stated, "There may not be many, but they still exist." Ostman made his way into the woods carrying his rifle, along with 2 boxes of shells and a backpack stuffed with supplies that weighed over 80 pounds. He made his camp and then moved on several times in his first 4 days. The first morning, after setting up his newest campsite, he found that someone or something had visited his camp during the night. He believed it had been porcupines, or porkies, as he called them. And though things had been moved, nothing appeared to be missing. The next morning, he found that his backpack had been emptied out and scavenged, and some of his food rations were missing. He didn't find any tracks, however, and he now began to doubt that it was a porky. He put everything back together, but when he went to bed that night, he intended to stay up all night and see who or what his visitor was. He decided not to undress, but only took his shoes off, and he left them in the bottom of his sleeping bag. He drove his prospecting axe into the tree nearby so he could reach it during the night if he needed it. He also kept his rifle close at hand. Despite his plan to stay awake all night, he nodded off at some point. He was awoken during the night by something picking him up inside his sleeping bag. Once he got his wits back about him and he realized what was happening, he at first assumed that he had been caught in a snow slide, but there wasn't any snow around his camp. He then thought that maybe he had been tossed on horseback, but he could feel that the person who carried him was walking. He tried to unsheath his knife, but he wasn't able to due to the position he was stuck in. Ostman could feel his captor climbing uphill and then down, and he estimated he was carried for about 3 hours. Finally, he was dropped down and made his way out of the sleeping bag, but his legs were too numb to run. He could hear chatter all about him, and he estimated there were at least 4 of them, but he couldn't make out any details. He asked, "What do you fellows want with me?" The chatter continued, but no one answered him. He still had his rifle, and he gripped it tightly. As it got lighter, he could make out the figures, and he saw 2 large hair-covered creatures and 2 smaller, younger ones. It was a Sasquatch family. He said the children appeared to be frightened of him, and the mom did not appear pleased at all with what the dad had dragged home. The dad continued to chat in a language that he did not understand, apparently telling his family what he had in mind. Whatever that was. Ostman's watch told him that it was now 4:25 a.m. So he was on a small valley surrounded by high peaks with only a small opening for getting in or out on one side. The father sat near this opening, blocking his exit, but they otherwise left him alone. He ate his canned food, and the kid showed curiosity about him and his items. On the second day, he packed his things and attempted to leave, but the father blocked his way and shoved him back. Ostman was prepared to shoot his way out, but he only had 6 shells, and he doubted that he could do so. He decided to bide his time and devise another plan. Ostman later wrote a long account of his encounter, and rather than paraphrase his description of his captors, I'm going to use his own words, so these are his words. The old lady was a meek old thing. The young fellow was by this time quite friendly. The girl would not hurt anybody. Her chest was flat like a boy's, no development like the young lady's. I am sure if I could get the old man out of the way, I could easily have brought this girl up with me to civilization. But what good would that have been? I would have to keep her in a cage for public display. I don't think we have any right to force our way of life on other people, and I don't think they would like it. The noise and racket in a modern city, they would not like it any more than I do. The young fellow might have been between 11 and 18 years old. He was about 7 feet tall and might weigh 300 pounds. His chest would be 50 to 55 inches, his waist about 36 to 38 inches. He had wide jaws, narrow forehead that slanted upward around the back, about 4 or 5 inches higher than the forehead. The hair on their heads was about 6 inches long. The hair on the rest of their body was short and thick in places. The woman's hair on the forehead had an upward turn like some women have. They call it bangs amongst women's hairdos. Nowadays, the old lady could have been anything between 40 and 70 years old. She was over 7 feet tall. She would be about 500 to 600 pounds. She had very wide hips and a goose-like walk. She was not built for beauty or speed. Some of those lovable brassieres or uplifts would have been a great improvement on her looks and her figure. The man's eye teeth were longer than the rest of the teeth, but not long enough to be called tusks. The old man must have been near 8 foot tall. Big barrel chest and a big hump on his back. Powerful shoulders. His biceps on upper arms were enormous and tapered down to his elbows. His forearms were longer than common people have, but well proportioned. His hands were wide, the palm was long and broad, and hollow, like a scoop. His fingers were short in proportion to the rest of his hand. His fingernails were like chisels. The only place they had no hair was inside their hands, and the soles of their feet, and the upper part of their nose and eyelids. I never did see their ears. They were covered with hair hanging over them. If the old man were to wear a collar, it would have been at least 30 inches. I have no idea what size shoes they would need. I was watching the young fellow's foot one day when he was sitting down. The soles of his feet seemed to be padded like a dog's foot, and the big toe was longer than the rest and very strong. In mountain climbing, all he needed was footing for his big toe. They were very agile. To sit down, they turned their knees out and came straight down. To rise, they came straight up without help of hands or arms. I don't think this valley was their permanent home. I think they moved from place to place as food is available in different localities. They might eat meat, but I never saw them eat meat or do any cooking. So that's the end of his description. I'm back to paraphrasing.
He's very, it's crazy as the story is. He's very descriptive on what he says they look
like. Very, very descriptive. So he surmised that the valley was likely not their home, like he just said, but rather a stopover point. The creatures never attempted to harm him and largely left him alone. The boy became comfortable around him, and the old man was curious about his snuff. He thought that if he could get the old man to take enough of it, it might make him sick and give him a chance to escape. So one morning while he was drinking coffee, he took out a new can of his snuff and took a large pinch. Before he could close the tin, the old man grabbed it out of his hand and swallowed the whole can. His eyes rolled over in his head, and he emptied the coffee grounds into his mouth as well. Like he tried to chug a can of coffee. When that didn't help, he bolted away, likely to the stream to get water. Osman grabbed his things and bolted for the opening. The mother was right on his tail. So he fired his rifle into the rocks above, and he heard her change direction and instantly run the other way. He carefully made his way through the canyon, constantly looking behind him to see if they were in pursuit. He hiked for several hours, and when he felt safe enough, he camped for the night. After several more hours of hiking the next day, he came upon a logging camp. He told them he was a lost prospector, but he made no mention of the Sasquatch abduction. I don't blame him.
Yeah, you can tell him anyway that shit.
The next day, he made his way back to the inlet and caught a boat back to Vancouver. He never went prospecting again. He never encountered a Sasquatch again, and he didn't speak or write about the incident for 34 years. By 1957, tales of Sasquatch and Bigfoot were becoming commonplace in Canada and the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., so he became more comfortable telling others about his tale, and the press eventually caught wind of it. Some found his tale intriguing, most find it far-fetched and amusing. If it is made up, he put an insane amount of time concocting it. But if it's true, it's terrifying and fascinating.
Yet it doesn't exactly. A lot of it sounds like a Bigfoot. Some of it sounds like just a hairy human. You know what I mean?
And this, right. This story is so far-fetched.
All right, so one part for me, though. So if it's true, it tells you how much time this guy spent alone by himself in the woods, that he took the time to scope out the younger Sasquatch's rack.
Yeah.
And thought to himself, if he could get rid of her dad, he could take her to the city with him, because he actually comments on that. And then he wonders what the 600-pound mom might look like in a brassiere.
Dude's lonely. He's just definitely lonely.
So they're terrifying, but he's still creepy as shit.
Yeah, he is.
All right, she's a Sasquatch, but she's hot.
You see that rack?
You put the right set of lingerie on her, and she's going to look good.
Yeah. You comb that chest hair. And
he's a creepy fucker.
Yeah, this story is crazy.
Yeah, I'm gonna put that story to 3. It's possible, but I just...
I'm going to put it down to 1 or 2. Boy, I don't know if this is the one, but I thought I read... The guy who wrote this, did he write other stuff?
I don't think so, no.
No? I must be thinking of something else.
I could be wrong. I even deeply into this one. I'm just familiar with this story.
Yeah, a bunch of papers wrote about this, didn't they?
He's a creepy old fucker. I've seen pictures of him and stuff. But, you know, he didn't... So the story happened in 24. He didn't write about it until 57. Who knows what happened in all those years? It probably evolved or devolved so far.
The story?
From what happened, or if anything happened, it gave him years to write it. Or
he's very descriptive about what they looked like. And to me, I mean, they sound Sasquatch-like, but they also, he described them more human-like, too.
Yeah.
Of course, who would really know?
In that terrifying situation, would you really envision the 600-pound mom in a brassiere?
6 days, he'd already been out there for what? Yeah, probably. I've been there. I get it, dude.
They took us porn.
You don't know. She could have been hot. And he was all kidnapped and stuff.
I shouldn't judge. His thing is different than mine. It happens. We're not all into the same stuff.
So, I mean, those are the stories that we have on Bigfoot. There's a billion of them out there.
Oh, we just scratch on the surface.
Yeah. Sure. As far as Bigfoot goes, we're going to do that on a scale of 1 to 10. Like I said, this is the most likely of all cryptids as far as I'm concerned. Take out the crazy stories.
You do, yeah. Just or the Bigfoot itself, I'm going to put it a 9 solid.
Yeah, I'm an 8 or 9 on Bigfoot for sure.
Yeah, but yeah, the stories we told tonight might not sell you. But
no, but these are famous stories.
Yeah,
these aren't just run. If you look, these are famous stories.
We'll come back to it for sure.
Yeah,
we cover a lot of stuff, as you guys have heard. Can't do everything on every episode. We'll visit Bigfoot again for sure.
Yeah. So, well, guys, we hope you like it. And we will catch you in the next one.
Like we said, we're skipping the fire pit tonight, and that's because we just don't have them. There's just not enough. So write in beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com or send them to our socials. We desperately need fire pits, and we know you guys are sitting on a mountain of good stuff. Funny stories, scary stories, paranormal stories, just anything that sounds interesting, you tell your friends around the fire pit. We'd love to hear it right into us, and we'll catch you next week, guys.
Later. Catch you in the next.